Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. Zach has turned the light on, so the time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, July 18th. I'm Alan Shartok. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from ClipCentric Albany, a local video services division of ClipCentric, producing video advertisements for business throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV. Albany.ClipCentric.com. ClipCentric.com. Joining us today is Dr. Paul Lemanski of the Capital Care Center for Preventive Medicine in Albany. Dr. Lemanski is here to take your questions. He knows about everything. Believe me, he's a brilliant doctor. It's going to be a busy hour, so be sure to get your calls in early. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Want to stay healthy? Call Dr. Lemanski. Let's hear from you. Well, hello, everybody. It's now 2:08 and 58 seconds. Welcome to Medical Monday, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Paul Lemanski joins us today to respond to your questions. I love Paul Lemanski and comments. He comes to us from the Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine. Dr. Lemanski is a board-certified internship with a master's degree in human nutrition. He's a graduate of New York Medical College. Prior to his work at the Center for Preventative Medicine, Dr. Lemanski was clinical chief for cardiovascular health for Kaiser Permanente's Northeast Division. He's a currently assistant clinical professor of medicine at Albany Medical College, a fellow of the American College of Physicians. Paul Lemanski, you are a great guy. Thank you so much for agreeing to be with us today. I appreciate it so
Absolutely.
Much. Absolutely. Yeah. And 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Paul Lemanski, we were listening to the problem of the emerging Zika virus. Do you expect it to get this far?
Well, you know, there are people infected in New York State who were traveling outside the country.
Right.
So that's not too surprising. Whether there's going to be transmission from those individuals to other individuals is the big question.
But we do know some of those mechanisms of, for example, sexual contact, right?
That's right. That's right. So sexual contact will transmit it, mostly from men to women, but now there's some evidence that it also goes in the other direction, from women to men. And, you know, CDC is investigating, you know, this case where there does not appear to be the usual mechanisms of transmission involved.
Yeah. And you just heard about it on the news.
Yeah, a caretaker. So, you know, it gets a little bit
Could
concerning.
Be in the saliva, right? Something like that?
It is in the saliva. It is in the saliva.
So if a caretaker, you know, just is picking up after somebody without gloves or anything else on, or even breathing it in, there could be a problem.
We don't know about breathing it in yet, but certainly, you know, and the other question is whether the individual might have been bitten by a mosquito that then transmitted it, but I think that's pretty remote.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, do you mind? You know the drill? Can we take a call?
Sure.
Okay, and 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll talk to Bill in Gloversville, where nobody goes barehanded. Okay, Bill, you're on.
Good afternoon, doctors. I'll make this question as brief as possible.
Good. It's already too long. Go ahead.
I have heard that the three most important things that you can do for your health is, one, to quit smoking, which I did a year ago, two, to exercise, and three, nutrition. Now, regarding exercise, I was wondering, I know that Alan bicycles an hour a day, every day.
Every day, never
and
miss.
And I have started bicycling a half an hour a day, every day. And I was wondering, what is the optimum level of exercise per day, every day, that a person should do without the law of diminishing returns kicking in and you're doing yourself more harm than good?
It's actually a very good question.
It's a very good question. That's difficult to answer without knowing your medical background. So, for example, it might be different for a person who has established heart disease than it may be for someone who doesn't. But for all comers, there generally is a recommendation is 30 minutes of some moderate activity 5 days a week. So that would be like brisk walking, or 15 minutes of more intensive exercise, such as jogging. Again, we wouldn't recommend that someone jog. We would more recommend that they walk. It's much safer from a musculoligamentous perspective. So you're less likely to injure your ligaments, your tendons, your joints walking than jogging, just less force being placed on the joints.
Well, but how about how about bike versus walking? I do both, but how about bike versus walking?
I think it's six of one, half a dozen of another.
Is it?
The piece is that when you're biking, it's difficult to know exactly how many calories are being expended and that kind of thing.
Right.
We also have something called the Borg scale of perceived exertion. So, for example, you might say, well, okay, if I choose to walk, how much walking do I have to do that's enough? Well, most folks would say total daily walking should be about 10,000 steps, which is 4.7 miles.
Wow.
But you might also look at what we talk about 30 minutes. We're talking about active minutes of exercise.
Yeah.
And those active minutes, how do you gauge when you're walking, whether you're walking fast enough or slow enough to be, again, not too fast so you're not going to be increasing your risk, not too slow so you're not going to be getting a benefit. One of the ways of doing that is the Borg scale of perceived exertion. So you should be able to carry on a conversation with an individual and get out a full sentence. If you can't get out a full sentence when you're walking, then that's probably you're going too slow. Too quickly.
Yeah.
If you can get out more than one sentence, then you're probably going too slow.
Yeah, right. Well, I do 4 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly 4 miles. Takes me an hour and 10 minutes.
Now you're on an exercise bike, correct?
No.
You're outside.
When I walk outside.
I
then I walk. But on an exercise bike, I do 1 hour.
Okay.
And that can, as you're right, it can tell you. Now there are all kinds of apps now, Paul, which will tell
Absolutely.
You how far you've gone, what your heart rate is, this kind of thing. So I use something called Map My Walk. And a lady comes on and she tells you, you've done a mile, you've done 2 miles, you've done 3 miles, 4 miles, like that.
I think it's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything that we can do to increase exercise. Now, to get back to some of what the speaker was saying in terms of listing did we answer your question, by the way? Did I answer
yes,
your
sir.
Question?
Very okay. much so.
Okay.
I do both as Alan does. I walk and I bicycle, depending on the weather.
Oh, that sounds great. Now, in terms of, the benefit, probably smoking cessation is going to get you the most bang for the buck.
Is that really true?
Yeah, it is. It's actually a 50% drop in cardiovascular risk by smoking cessation.
Really?
So it's rather dramatic.
And how long does it take before? In other words,
well,
I have friends who used to smoke, but 10 years later, they haven't smoked a long time.
Right. So that varies. I would say it probably takes about a year or more for the risk for cardiovascular disease to drop. But it starts, it's not a linear thing. It drops off rather quickly initially, but it reaches, a nadir after about a year or two. For cancer, for lung cancer issues, it could be as long as 10 to 15 years.
Uh-huh.
So depending upon, again, how much you smoked and, the length of time that you smoked. But smoking cessation is probably the most preventable, not necessarily the easiest thing to do, but the most preventable thing that we can do for preventing disease.
Okay, so you care about people, and
yeah.
I care very
much.
So
you're talking about strokes, you're talking about heart attacks, and you're talking about cancers.
So if you love your friends, how do you get them to stop?
Well, we've
got people here who smoke.
Yeah, that's a complicated issue, obviously. But most people would say, that most physicians would say, that a person has to want to stop smoking.
Yeah, that's
so,
my problem.
Yeah, and the way that an individual comes to that realization is by running into some problems associated with smoking. So, for example, if they come in with a pneumonia or they come in with recurrent bronchitis, it becomes a little easier to point out to them the consequences of their actions. Otherwise, if they have no consequences and they smoke for a while, it becomes difficult to convince them that they're not going to be able to smoke until they're 99 years old and die of something else.
Yeah, and of course, there's always the question of when you have that event that makes you turn things around, maybe too late.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it, Bill. And
thank you very much, doctors. Have a good one.
All right. And now I'm always back to looking at this new machine and how you work and all like that. Oh, hang up. There's a little thing here that says hang up. Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you want to say something else?
Yeah, I just want to say that the next most important thing for preventing disease is probably achieving a normal body weight or a near normal body weight.
So how do you know what your normal body weight is? Look, you know, I'm 131.4 this morning. How's that?
Well, you can go online and look for something called a body mass index.
Yeah.
Okay, and there'll be a body mass index calculator online, and you can plug in your height and your weight. And basically what it will do, will put those two numbers together to come up with this kind of an index so you can compare people of various heights and how overweight or underweight they may be. And a BMI between 19 and 25 is probably a reasonable one to achieve. BMIs 25 to 30 are considered overweight, and over 30 are considered obese.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly people with BMIs over 30 should do things to reduce their weight, get down into the overweight category, or maybe even into the normal body weight category.
You hate people. You help people do this stuff.
You can. You can help
people.
No, I mean
you
personally. Yes. Yes, we do.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be right back.
Support comes from Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication, used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. New York Oncology Hematology, providing comprehensive care for all stages of cancer and blood disorders, offering clinical drug trials for FDA approval of new cancer treatments. Open trials online, newyorkoncology.com. Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in Makoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis, healthquest.org/ortho. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts, over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more, harolds.com. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts, family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services and deliveries, georgepropane.com. And from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com.
Thanks for bringing us back to reality, Zachary. Appreciate that very much. We're here with Dr. Paul Lemansky. It is our great fortune to have him. He comes to us from the Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine. He is a longtime friend of this radio station and has done magnificent work for us. Okay, Paul, you ready? We're going back to the phones now, and I'm looking at this thing. Okay, it says number two. Okay, number two. All right. And now we're on with Melissa. Melissa, you're on.
Hi, Doctor. I have a question about the Borealis bacteria that causes Lyme disease, among other issues.
Borrelia.
I have been tested three times this year for Lyme, but apparently I've only been tested for one strain, and I guess there's several. So my question is, should I request doxycycline as a treatment with knowing that I have several of the symptoms? I've been tested for many other things and I'm really healthy. Everything seems to come up clean. I just have this body buzzing and exhaustion and weird nerve stuff going on.
Right. Well, you know, you've been tested for Lyme disease and the Lyme disease test came back negative. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
But so, I was told that it's only tests for one strain and that there are several that can cause the same issues?
Well, I'm unaware that we routinely test for just one strain, or it seems to me that the test that's done is pretty sensitive and pretty specific for Lyme disease. There are a lot of course, there's great controversy in Lyme in terms of how long you treat for, people having negative tests and being treated because of symptoms. I really don't subscribe to that. I think we need to have both symptoms and some tests showing that you're indeed dealing with Lyme. Now, there are other tick-borne diseases that can produce symptoms similar to Lyme. So when one is tested for Lyme, generally we're testing for these other diseases, Ehrlichia, anaplasmosis. These are Babesia. These are different disease processes carried by and different organisms carried by ticks. And if you haven't been tested for those things before you get into more subspecialized testing with an infectious disease expert, for example, I think you'd want to at least have those tests completed.
Okay. So there's testing for these, and they also cause the same sort of symptoms through the nervous system.
They can cause symptoms that are overlap areas. So a lot of the symptoms of Lyme are somewhat confusing to patients and to clinicians because there's so many different types of symptoms depending upon which stage of the disease you're in. So in investigating these things, I think the first thing to do is use a broad stroke to try and make sure that you're not dealing with one of these other tick-borne diseases. Then you might want to see an infectious disease specialist or a rheumatologist if you have concerns that you're not being appropriately tested. I would say most of the time we do a Lyme screening test that has a reflex test in it for a specialized type of blood test called a Western blot test, which can then look more specifically and with more sensitivity at whether or not you're indeed dealing with the Lyme organism.
Thank you very much for your call. All right, now we are going to go to Jim, our regular correspondent from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on. You're on, Jim.
I was wondering if you had any information on the new study that says that calcium channel blockers, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, and so on and so forth have little to no effect on the long-term consequences of high blood pressure.
I'm unaware of that study. Where was that published?
I'm not quite sure. I believe it may have been the NIH.
Well,
I heard it from Joel Thurman.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen that, but what I can tell you is that certainly with regard to ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers, there are many studies, not just one, but many studies showing its benefit over time, especially in those individuals with hypertension. So, you know, one study does not mean we turn everything else, all the other prior studies that have been done on their head and say, okay, this is wrong. A so-called landmark study, it would have to be very large, very well-powered, so that it would be generalizable to a large number of individuals for us to change management based upon one study.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, now we're going to go to Donna. And Donna is... where's Donna? Okay, then Donna is on line number 4. Donna, you're on.
Hello?
Hi, Donna.
Hi. My question is medical marijuana in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
What's required to get it? Where do you get it? And what form can you get it in?
Okay, well, you can only get it from a physician who is certified to prescribe it.
Are you?
No.
Do you want to be?
Not particularly.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So there are certain indications, and again, this is controversial as well. There are certain indications, patients on chemotherapy, for example, the nausea associated with chemotherapy, there have been studies showing that those people benefit from Mallarone and medical marijuana. These are generally going to be, you're not going to give you marijuana to smoke type of a thing. This is going to be a medicinal. So depends on what your symptoms are and whether the prescriber feels that what you are, what symptoms you have would be helped by medical marijuana. So a lot of that is left to the discretion. A lot of that is left to the discretion of the prescribing physician. But New York State has tried to have specific categories of diagnostic categories and certain specific conditions for which medical marijuana can appropriately be used.
So, for example, cancer or glaucoma or something like that?
Glaucoma, you know, it's an interesting thing with regard to glaucoma because there have been widespread anecdotal reports of marijuana affecting intraocular pressure and glaucoma and be an alternative treatment for some individuals who may have that condition. There are no randomized prospective clinical trials, so a lot of the ophthalmologists in the area are very reluctant to use a medication like this that really has not been proved in clinical trials to really affect intraocular pressure and glaucoma progression.
Okay, Donna, anything else on this?
Well, so I've had 4 hip replacements and foot surgery, and I was diagnosed after the fourth hip replacement because of pain with HNPCP, nerve compression. It's a genetic thing. And I have damaged liver function because of use of antisteroidal drugs all these years trying to control pain. So I was wondering if this would qualify to get some form of marijuana.
I think
it has been helpful.
Sure. I think the thing to do would be to get referred by your primary care doctor to a pain management specialist if you haven't been referred already. And then there are some neurologists in the area that and other physicians who do, prescribe medical marijuana. And you'd have to take that issue up with them specifically as to whether or not they'd be willing to prescribe it for those conditions of chronic pain.
So I was already diagnosed by a pain physician.
Okay. Did he make a recommendation for medical marijuana?
Not at the time, no, because I didn't know it was available in New York State, and I didn't know it would help.
Whether it helps or not is a different issue. So no matter what a medication is, doesn't always help everybody equally. Some people it helps, some people it doesn't help. This is true for blood pressure medicines, not simply medical marijuana. But I think I'm not an expert in medical marijuana. You'd want to certainly talk to somebody who was certified to prescribe it.
And how could you find out? You go to the New York State.
GP.
You go to the New York State Department of Health or something like that.
Yeah.
Donna, thank you. Okay, let's go now. Let's see here. I'm looking at this thing here. Let's go to Patrick in Troy. I want to give everybody the number 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are very good. Patrick in Troy, you're on. Go.
Hello, thank you. Pernicious anemia. We're concerned about that and the role that vitamin B12 plays in it.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that it's it requires an intrinsic factor to
be absorbed.
Do what it needs to do.
Be absorbed
and be beneficial.
Yep. Yep.
I understand. I think that the liver stores B12. We wonder though if the liver is also able to manufacture B12 if the body's supplies are diminished?
Sure. No, actually, the body cannot, and that's why you need to take B12 as some sort of a vitamin supplement it is included in your food, as an example. So if you're eating animal products, you're probably going to be getting B12. Now, you're quite
not
right.
Not much of that in our diet, though.
That's true. But you're quite right that you need intrinsic factor. Whatever B12 you are swallowing, in food or in vitamins, requires substance that's made by the stomach cells, to bind the B12 for purposes of absorption. That's what you had referred to as intrinsic factor. Some folks don't have intrinsic factor for one reason or another.
Okay.
They may have had, a stomach bypass resection, or they may have had some damage to their stomach, so they don't produce intrinsic factor.
What about a hiatal hernia? No, not generally.
That generally isn't going to affect it. But for whatever reason, I mean, what you would like to do is to see that the blood level of B12 is low. If the blood level of B12 is low, most clinicians are going to prescribe injections to increase the amount of B12 in the system so that you don't have either anemia or any of the neurological complications of pernicious anemia.
And those would be slowness in answering questions? I mean, it seems like the Jeopardy answers
no,
don't come
well,
up
not,
quickly
no.
as they should
B12,
these days.
B12 deficiency could cause tingling and numbness in the feet and in the hands. It could cause difficulty in walking in the dark because the body's ability to know in the dark without any visual cues, the body's ability to know where your limbs are, where your legs and feet are, going to be dependent on certain receptors in the joints and in the muscles that help tell the brain what the position of your limbs are. And that is something called the posterior columns of the spinal cord. You can have B12 deficiency injure those posterior columns of the spinal cord, and therefore you lose the ability to tell where your limbs are in subdued light.
So how much, Paul, how much B12 should one take?
Well, you know, B12 is a water-soluble vitamin. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of B12, a multivitamin with B12 for individuals who are normal. For individuals who are not normal, Alan, though, you can't easily overcome by taking lots and lots and lots of the drug. You can't overcome the amount of or increase the absorption of the B12 necessarily. So that's why you have to take it by an intramuscular injection. There are some people that are using a sublingual B12 being absorbed directly into the mucous membranes of the mouth. So it completely bypasses the intrinsic factor restriction.
Patrick, thank you. Okay, and now we're going to go, according to this machine here, we're going to go to Nancy. All right, Nancy is in Amsterdam. Nancy, is that you? I say, is that you?
Hi.
Is that you? Go ahead.
Yes. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, I don't so much have a question, but a cautionary tale to share. Just based on one of your previous callers who called about the smoking, and Ben Allen, you asked about how do you get the people you love to stop smoking.
Right.
And I just wanted to briefly share with you, I married a man who started smoking when he was 13 years old. He smoked for the 25 years we were together, and he just could not stop. Even when our children became old enough to realize that the lessons they were being taught in school, that it was bad not only for them to smoke, but for daddy to smoke, and they started nagging where I left off, and it never made a difference. He couldn't stop smoking unless he had his own reason to stop, and I think that's probably true of every smoker out there. But I just wanted to share that my children, because he couldn't stop smoking, lost their father when he was just 56 years old, and they were all in their early 20s, but to me that was much too early to lose a parent. It was very, very difficult for them. And so if it's a lesson for anyone out there, please take your children's photos out of your wallet, look them in the eye, and realize that if for nothing else, you should stop smoking so that they don't have to cry at your graveside that comes too early.
Great cautionary tale. I appreciate you calling so much.
And I think
thank you for letting me.
Sure.
Have a good day.
And I think, Alan, you know, people should realize that there is definitely help for folks who want to quit smoking.
Sure.
You know, there are medications out there that'll help people to quit smoking. Their acupuncture can help people quit smoking. There are, you know, your primary care physician is probably the individual that you should address the question with initially. There is New York State has a smoking cessation hotline, and you can be directed to smoking cessation classes as well.
Thank you, Paul, for that. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
support comes from Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. Maria College, Albany, bachelor's and associate's degrees in health sciences, nursing, liberal arts, and management, day, evening, and weekend programs, Fast Track Admissions Day this Thursday, 9 to 6, newmariacollege.com. Protex Gloves, helping to provide relief from chronic skin and hand conditions, including peripheral neuropathy, scleroderma, Raynaud's, eczema, UVA, and UVB sun protection. ProtexGloves.com. Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. The Tank Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond, skidmore.edu/tang. And from Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com.
We are back with our very good friend, Paul Lemansky. We'll go to Kara on line number one. Will we? No, can't be. Line number two. Okay, Kara, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're okay. We're just talking about how okay
we are. Good. Okay, well, listen, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share something with, I think it was three callers ago, who has some experience with Lyme disease.
Right.
Okay, so I just want to share my experience, and hopefully I'll help her and maybe some other people. Mm. I got diagnosed last summer with Lyme disease. I got a round of the doxycycline, and it did not help. Then I got diagnosed with malaria, which turned out to be not true as well. I finally got diagnosed with babesia.
There you go.
That makes sense.
That's what I had mentioned.
And it was a simple round of quinine, and the quinine was tough to take, but it was a week long, and I mean, I have some residual, but not any kind near of the horror stories I hear from other people. So
okay, hold on.
Am I allowed to say the name of the doctor who treated me?
No. You certainly are not. Right. Okay, Paul, you wanted to say what?
No, I think that the quinine was probably related to malarial treatment. But yes, this is what I was saying before. Ehrlichia, babesia, anaplasmosis are tick-borne illnesses that can mimic Lyme and should be checked for. So it's I think a good example that you were checked appropriately and you were treated appropriately, and now you're feeling better.
Kara,
I feel like a new person. So thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Kara. All right, and let's go now. Let's go now to Alan, and Alan is on line number three. Okay, Alan, you're on. Alan.
Thank you for taking my call.
How old are you? How old are you?
How old am I? I'm 66.
You see, there aren't that many Alans who are being born right now, like you and me.
Are you one L or two L?
One L. There's only one way.
There's only one. We got the L out.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly. Well said. Go ahead, Alan.
Anyway, having been a former smoker for 40 years, why hasn't the AMA banned nicotine without a prescription?
Banned it? Why have they not banned nicotine? You'll have to ask the AMA.
Why do you not need a prescription to buy nicotine?
You can buy you can buy nicotine patches. I mean, they're not.
I know, but why don't you need a prescription to buy nicotine?
Oh, great sage.
Well, you know, why don't you need a prescription to buy aspirin? I mean,
Because aspirin is not addictive.
Well, if you want to, I'm not suggesting that it's not appropriate. The reason why that people can do it is because I believe, that was used in the initial treatment. It used to be a prescription for patches. If you take people the patches away from them, and then you make it only possible for people who go to a doctor to get patches.
Sir, I'm not asking about the patches.
No, you're asking a rhetorical question. He's not here to defend.
I'm asking about cigarettes, the nicotine and cigarettes.
Yeah, no,
why
don't you need a prescription to get
a cigarette?
Yeah.
This
is a political question.
It's a political. It's not a medical question. I mean, this is a problem that's existent. I mean, if you're going to start suddenly saying to get cigarettes, you need a prescription, that's a huge alteration in the way things are done, and I think it's going to be very difficult to enforce.
Well, even if it isn't difficult to enforce, you got a Congress of the United States, you got tobacco raising states,
you got employed people,
they're not going to do it. Yeah, thank you very much.
It would be nice if it were true.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things
that. We're all for it, Alan, with one L. Thank you. Okay, so 1-800-348-2551. Line number six. We're going to go to line number six now and get Jeannie from Wilton. Jeannie, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed with small fiber length dependent neuropathy about 5 years ago, also polyneuropathy, and I've been to several neurologists. We haven't figured it out. But recently I was told, and I would like the doctor's opinion on this, that they're finding that people who are not diabetic that are diagnosed with the small fiber length-dependent neuropathy 10 years later will be type 2 diabetic. They're finding a relationship. And I do have, when I have my blood sugar tested, the fasting blood sugar is normal, but the A1C is in that next level up where it could be kind of pre-diabetes. Mm-hmm. So my question is, do you know anything about the relationship, and do you think that that's something I should look into?
I don't know about the relationship, but I do think that someone whose hemoglobin A1C is in the range slightly elevated. So just for the listeners, normal hemoglobin A1C, and what is it? Hemoglobin A1C is an average blood sugar measurement over a three-month period. And we call it hemoglobin A1C because hemoglobin, which is the pigment in red blood cells, not only binds oxygen, it also binds glucose. So the blood hemoglobin in an average individual, the percent of their red cells, the hemoglobin, which is bound, binds glucose, is about 5.6% or less. If you have a hemoglobin A1C over 6.4, it's considered diabetes. And if you have a hemoglobin A1C between 5.7 and 6.4, that's considered pre-diabetes. Now, there's a whole host of abnormalities in individuals who are pre-diabetic. And it doesn't surprise me that there might be an association between, and even a causal association between hemoglobin A1C abnormalities and neuropathy. As you know, people with diabetes can have neuropathy. There are also probably going to be changes, ophthalmological changes in the eye in people with metabolic syndrome that haven't been fully studied. We're basically identifying folks who are pre-diabetic and trying to help them to get their blood sugars down. There are several different ways of doing that, but one of the most powerful ways of doing it is in an individual who's in that range that you're describing. If you are overweight or have problems with increased body weight, by dropping your body weight, you can decrease conversion from that pre-diabetic state to actual diabetes by up to 57%. So while there are some medications that can help in doing that, certainly lifestyle change and being able to moderate body weight are a very powerful way to do so.
What do you think about alpha-lipoic acid? My body weight isn't a problem, and I'm a really pretty healthy eater, so it's been kind of hard to solve it except for avoiding carbs and sugars. That's what I've been doing, and my doctor said I've been taking my, doing a prick and testing my blood sugar, seeing what the level is a couple hours after I eat. And I haven't come out with any readings that were particularly bad. But when my A1C was tested, out of 4 out of 5 times, it came out above 5.6. It was 5.7, 5.8, 6.0. Mm-hmm. So that's why we thought there might be a problem. It was actually two physicians that told me. So I guess it is some current research that's coming out who was both an endocrinologist and a neurologist.
Okay, hold on. Go ahead.
I would like to know if you have diabetes in your family.
Yes, my grandmother, my father, both my mother and father's side. I don't have any siblings, so I don't know that. But yes, my father did and my grandmother did, and also some people on my mother's
okay,
side.
Okay,
so,
hold on one second. Go
yeah,
ahead.
There are individuals who have normal body weight who have prediabetes. Those are a little bit more difficult to treat, but average, you know, pre-diabetics are going to have, just like average people with type 2 diabetes, are going to have a weight issue or a weight problem. One of the ways, however, that you can lower your A1C, even without lowering your weight, is to exercise on a daily basis. So brisk walking will help lower A1C, even in the absence of weight loss.
I recognize that. I ended up with it's one of those, like, I'm going to catch 22, because I used to exercise a lot, and I ended up with a chronic bursitis in my hips, so I'm dealing with that right now. So, it kind of it enters the picture. But I just wondered if you had heard about a relationship. Do you use alpha lipoic acid with any patients?
No, I don't know of any data with that. That is, you know, there's a lot of anecdotal information, but not randomized prospective clinical trials.
Jeannie, gotta let you go. A lot of people behind you. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to. Number four. We're going to go to four, right, Joe? Four. Okay. Four is Pete in Cambridge, New York. Go ahead, Pete.
Yes, I had Lyme meningitis 8 years ago, and they didn't find it for 8 months because the blood test didn't find it, so they did a spinal tap, and they found it, and they put a PICC line in my arm, and they supposedly took care of it. And I was just reading an article yesterday that it could be a precursor for Alzheimer's. Could you talk about that?
I'm unaware of that. I would have to ask your rheumatologist. Who treated you, a rheumatologist or a neurologist?
You mean before they found it?
No, after they found it.
Oh, infectious disease specialist.
Okay. You know, I mean, there may be, dementia is pretty common in the culture, and so, you know, establishing causal linkage with something like Lyme disease is going to be pretty difficult to do. But certainly, I think the first person to go to ask with regard to that would be your neurologist and see whether they whether they have any information on that. I'm unaware of any link with dementia.
Have you tried? Have you tried Google?
No, I haven't. Is there any other, with Lyme meningitis, is there any other warnings that you have?
Well, if not, if you're fully treated, did all your symptoms resolve?
Well, no, the memory, they found it because it was a loss of memory, so, and I still have memory problems, so.
And you haven't seen a neurologist?
No.
I think that would be the next step, is to be evaluated by neurology. Did you have follow-up lumbar punctures done?
No, they just did follow-up blood testing, which would, didn't seem right. It seems like they should have done like what you just said.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would have a neurologist see you if you've got some cognitive, you know, problems associated with your history of Lyme disease and Lyme meningitis.
Okay.
It should be treatable.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it should be treatable.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, where are we going, Joe? Number seven. All right. I love the fact that Joe's helping out here with this complicated system. Okay, Tom in Kingston, you're on.
Hey, guys. So I'm 28. In 2010, I was diagnosed by my doctor in California with Lyme disease. Mainly, I got checked out because I'd been going to school in Vermont, and I was curious about it. Diagnosed me mainly because of my fatigue symptoms is why I got checked out in the first place. Since then, I've just basically been chasing my tail in regards to, one, trying to figure out what these symptoms of Lyme are actually doing to me and what they look like versus what is just sort of normal human condition. And I also suffer from depression, so fatigue, you know, spills over into that category as well.
For sure.
And I think at this point, I'm really having a hard time finding a doctor, whether it's an infectious disease specialist, a Lyme specialist, a regular doctor, that I feel 100% comfortable with their knowledge and their treatment practices. Because I got to say, a lot of these specialists do not fall under any insurance category. That's a political question, I believe, as to, you know, as well. But I think when I throw down $800 for an initial visit for one of these Lyme specialists, only to tell me I have to buy $300 more worth of their supplements, not from a Rite Aid, and it just, I think the trust factor of both the treatment options and also the just kind of elusive nature of the symptoms themselves, and figuring out what is kind of psychosomatic, knowing that I was tested for Lyme once and had it, and what is actually happening to me.
Okay,
you know, I'd say most of my symptoms are neurological.
Let's get an answer. Go ahead.
It's a very unfortunate circumstance. Lyme disease, you know, is extremely controversial, and treatment is extremely controversial. And we have a number of clinicians in the Hudson Valley, as an example, that will treat with antibiotics for very protracted periods of time. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, you know, certainly have not recommended this kind of, I've had a patient that was treated down in the Hudson Valley for 8 months with antibiotics for the entire 8 month period. And, you know, there is no evidence that that kind of length of treatment is necessary. That said, you know, it's important, as we had mentioned with a prior caller, that the appropriate diagnosis be made. You could have Lyme, and because it's tick-borne and there are other tick-borne illnesses, you could have another tick-borne illness that wouldn't necessarily respond to doxycycline. So,
Do I have to ask for those specific tests, like, up front, generally, if it was an infectious disease specialist, or is there a protocol to check off those boxes with any test as well?
Well, it depends. I think if they realize, you know, that you've been through this for, that you've been through an adequate treatment for Lyme disease and continue to have symptoms, yeah, it would be probably the next thing that one would do. If you followed up with that physician, would be one of the next things that they would do to look for these other tick-borne illnesses. Supplements do not have a place in any of the legitimate treatment of Lyme disease. Now, again, you've got folks in the Hudson Valley, and I question this, you know, they're the endemic areas, they get Lyme disease, they're treated for it, and even before they're, just after subsequently being treated for Lyme disease, they can get reinfected with Lyme disease. So they feel as though they are, you know, never getting better, when in essence, what's happening is they get reinfected multiple times. It's the tick you never see that's the one that gets you.
It's
It's important to try and keep things, you know, and treatment as specific as we possibly can. And Lyme testing is important. Following with an infectious disease expert, I think, or a rheumatologist is important. And, you know, you need to stick with either an academic medical center, if you've been through a number of different physicians for the treatment of Lyme, an academic medical center, and infectious disease experts at those places, or, you know, in Albany, certainly we have a number of infectious disease experts who would be helpful, or rheumatologists are also, it's kind of an overlap area where both rheumatology and infectious disease will have expertise.
Got to let you go. Thank you very much. Okay, let's see. Holding on for a long time has been B in line number two. Okay. Right, Joe? Line number two. Yeah, okay, B. I need you to do this really fast. We only have less than a minute. Go ahead.
Hi, folks. Thanks. Yeah, I had a question, but I'd rather share my Lyme story. It came up in my routine annual physical. I had a couple bars in my blood test. So my doctor did put me on a month of the antibiotics. But my understanding is that Lyme is a bacteria. So I went ahead and I did a green juice.
We're out of time. You got to hurry. We're out of time. Yeah, go ahead.
No wheat, no sugar, no yeast.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm going to have Paul respond to that. Paul?
There's no data as far as I know.
And you've got an advanced degree in nutrition as well.
There's no data as far as I know that those things would affect the course of Lyme disease.
Okay. We're sorry we left Sydney on the line. Sydney from Hadley, And we are so time. Sydney Simon, my old teacher. Thanks, Sid. But we can't take you today, but we will in the future. We thank you all. We're out of time right now. And I want to thank Paul Lemansky, who's always here for us, for doing this wonderful job. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Hudson Farmers Market, 6th and Columbia Street, Hudson, providing products and seasonal produce for more than 30 growers and producers. Saturdays, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. through November, HudsonFarmersMarketNewYork.com. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.